Thanks for coming to the second lecture of the series Thinking Out Loud, Lectures in Philosophy and Society. It is a great pleasure to have Sathi here as a speaker. For those of you who are not here on Monday, I'll briefly reiterate that Sathi is a professor at Columbia University, and his books include Dream Nation, a book on nationalism, and Does Literature Think on the relation between narrative and philosophy. And after the first lecture on Monday, I think maybe Sathis will quickly summarize the argument, so I will not try to do a botched job here for you. Sathis will be talking today on why I'm not a post-secularist. So we're looking forward to that.
Thank you, Dimitris, and thank you for coming again, those who were here on Monday, and welcome to the ones who were not. To give a sense of where we left off on Monday, I spoke about the concept of secular criticism, which is not quite a concept, I argued, meaning not certainly a theoretical concept, but a kind of a mode of practice, and I linked it to a kind of poetic mode of thinking, as opposed to a philosophical mode of thinking, strictly speaking, which led us into a discussion that I thought was very provocative, and we could go on further about the certain tradition of critique that would be essentially skeptical, where my colleague, Professor Compris, argued that I was in danger of falling into a certain kind of self-referential abyss. I will come back to this in a sense today from another angle, making an argument about how a skeptic, in fact, is one who takes positions, affirmative positions. This essay, all of these pieces are very different. None of them is similar to any of the others. This one is in some ways kind of personal. I don't mean to say autobiographical or anything like this. It's personal in the sense that I take very seriously the first person in this title. And I should say maybe how this came about. It was a kind of collective dare, a kind of collective wager by a group of us who are in the editorial collective of Boundary 2, which is a journal with a great deal of a very important history since the 1970s in continental philosophy and theory, has had various incarnations. The idea was proposed that we each encounter this question, why I'm not a post-secularist, from each one of us from his or her own standpoint and in his or her own language, in whatever field we come from. But I really took it very seriously literally, to address this from a certain first person position. This is very unusual, I must say, for me, this kind of writing. So bear with me. Why I'm not a post-secularist, and there is a rather direct answer. I'm not a post-secularist because I'm not even a secularist. I'm an atheist. Of these three presumed identifications, the last is the crucial one, if only because it resists the logic of identity, despite the explicit subjective affirmation, I am X. Saying this, I understand, aggravates the already peculiar syllogism I'm positing, which to some could appear to be sophistic. In the conventional sense, the phenomenon of atheism belongs to the history of secularization and may even be the apogee of the secular imagination. However, recent thinking on this issue, from Talal Asad's Genealogies of Religion onward, would correct this convention by specifically arguing that atheism is but an extension of the Christian imagination, and thereby carries, perhaps even exemplifies, Christianity's significations even if in another language. This tendency has been offered as indication of and has been celebrated as, and also celebrating in turn, the advent of an era that has been named post-secularist. The genealogy of this naming is complex and has not yet been written. At a basic level, however, we can say that the name post-secularism exhibits the worst of all post-designations. Generally, in my mind, a lazy way of codifying emergent historical terrains. The facile and proliferating nomenclature of all kinds of post-somethings bears with it the incapacitated response to the emergent and is thereby an already defeated designation. Certainly, it testifies to the impoverishment of the terms of discussion around contemporary problems and undermines whatever might be those genuine efforts to think otherwise. The term post-secular is particularly nonsensical to me. So is the term post-political, but that's a whole other discussion. In order to have any rigor at all, post-secular would have to mean that either some sort of pure secularity has been achieved, that the so-called process of secularization had been completed, or that the secular has been left behind, outmaneuvered, or indeed abolished by another social imaginary horizon. We know that entertaining the first possibility is absurd by any account of present history. Besides, as I have argued, secularization is unfinishable by its very terms as historical project. If the second were indeed to be true, then what is the condition to which we have now newly arrived? Let's give it a name. We don't want to say religiosity or even religion as such, in whatever form religion might be incarnated in various languages. First, again on the simple basis of the present historical record, because we have never left the world of religion. Second, because we claim to want to deconstruct the world religion, and in any case, we object to the simplistic ideological notion of the so-called resurgence of religion. But nor do we want to concede to the name secular, yet we invoke it with a general prefix that, as if by some inordinate magic, renames it in the very claim to have made it vanish. These are regrettable contortions. To call our present historical moment post-secular is testimony to our incapacity to deconstruct the secular. One of the reasons, not the only one, is precisely the unwillingness to confront secular criticism as an experimental and self-interrogative engagement with the social historical, or even more, as a poetic encounter with the social imaginary of our times. This is what I spoke about on Monday. Instead, we confound secular criticism with the institution of secularism, whose metaphysics we conveniently identify as the new theology, and washing our hands of the latter, for who would deconstruct theology anymore, we settle comfortably in the armchair of the post-secular. Now, I've obviously engaged in a characteristic use of we, for I don't think there is any way to absolve oneself, if one wants to claim having anything to say on the matter, from complicity with or within the secular. The disjunction between the secular and the theological owes itself, first of all, to the fact of the failure of secularization, or perhaps more accurately, the incompleteness of secularization. The point would not be to explore in what ways secularization can be completed. The aspiration for completion is itself dictated by a theological desire. Something more modest is at stake, a historical claim. Secularization is of consequence precisely as a disruption of the Christian apocalyptic trajectory. It is a reorientation of the social imagination toward the validation of the finitude of life, mortality, over total finitude, rapture. And conversely, the validation of the infinite possibility of human invention over its restricted condition in the finality of an all-signifying God, or frankly, any all-signifying entity. This reorientation, expressly constituted against the monotheistic imaginary that eventually becomes globally dominant, is always partial. Curiously, I would argue, the metaphysics of secularism is an outcome of this partial turn, of this constitutive incompleteness, precisely as the remainder of the totalizing desire for completion. If secular criticism takes the task secularist metaphysics, which I argued on Monday, It cannot stay at the facile level of merely identifying theological remainders in a secular age, which is what has been happening a great deal nowadays. For this reason, yet again, it is an error to disavow the difference between secularism and secular criticism. The two cannot be equated, at the very least, I repeat, because secularism as an institutional metaphysics is one of the objects taken to task by secular criticism. The self-interrogative focus of secular criticism is not on how religion is secularized, but on how society is or is to be desacralized. It is in this specific context of interrogation that I invoke atheism as a point of departure. Now, for the sake of argument, permit me to make certain assertions, and I will not, for the purposes of this argument, contextualize my position in the course of the history of atheism. This is a very long and important history that I would have to reserve for a later and a longer piece of writing, and a different piece of writing. My position cannot be further away from both currently fashionable rationalist naturalist atheism, espoused by the likes of Richard Dawkins or Sam Harris, and the Christian-derived atheism of non-belief. I understand that the so-called post-secularists, that for the so-called post-secularists, the first is a mere conjuring of the second in a scientistic language. However, we need to hold on to the distinction, so as not to fall into the epistemological collapse that sees religion everywhere and in everything secular. Christian-derived atheism may be said to be distilled in the declaration, "I don't believe in God," or "I don't believe there is a God." This statement amounts to self-delusion, insofar as it refuses to acknowledge that the negation it claims participates in the terminological framework of belief, a discourse that, from the standpoint of religious conviction, belongs to the epistemology of God. Paraphrase Jacqueline Rose from a recent paper of hers, the specter of unbelievability is not a threat to belief. It belongs squarely to its signifying horizon. I call this atheism Christian-derived in order to accentuate its being inevitably marked by the condition of God is dead in its Nietzschean declaration, the trauma which, nonetheless, does not break down the necessity for belief. On the contrary, it reiterates and preserves, albeit by denying it, the semantics of belief as a prosthetic dependency, as an existential justification on whose crutch the debilitating encounter with the abyss of the world is allegedly yet again overcome. An atheism that will have emancipated itself from Christianity would render the matter of belief or non-belief in God irrelevant, or more significantly, would recognize it as a matter of performance. In saying this, I'm suggesting an all-out interrogation of transcendental authority that would hinge on how one can perform one's worldly existence without God, not out of some sort of conviction of belief in unbelief, but as a performance of a fact that eschews conviction, a performance of a fact that requires no demonstration or verification. This performance is always ephemeral, if nothing else, because its object is groundless. It has to be constantly reperformed, each time anew, discontinuously, even if constantly, repeated in utter singularity, untimely, and ungrounded. The reality of this performance resides in its virtuality, we can say. Such real virtual atheism would not be deconstructible. It's certainly not reducible to a convenient pretension, comfort zone, or conventional cynicism. Instead, it would stake out a position of living without presuming a content for the void of the real, of living by assuming the void as core with no need to justify it, explain it, theorize it, without a need for a transcendental metaperformative guarantee. This radical performative atheism would leave Christianity and all its social imaginary mechanisms behind. It would mean to live not as if God does not exist, but to live as if God does not matter. What does this mean? At the most elemental, it means that I live my life unconcerned as to whether people around me believe or don't believe in divinity. Unconcerned certainly does not mean oblivious, contemptuous, or disapproving. It means divested, disinterested. In that respect, it also means to be unconcerned with a Nietzschean proposition that God is dead. Those who still labor under the Nietzschean predicament assume, whether in cognizance or not, that there was a time when God was alive. The assumption that affirms divine existence, even if now lapsed, participates in the same imaginary that authorizes certain devout believers to confess that God speaks to them directly. Living as if God is dead is merely the end point in a continuous spectrum of belief. The death of God is a Christian proposition. The irrelevance of God, the void, is not. Christianity is the first, and so far only religion, to be founded on the altogether perverse notion of killing God. Of course, access to knowledge of this perversion is barred from the founding moment, because in Christianity, the killing of God is neither gratuitous nor an act of rebellion. God is put to death precisely so as to claim conquest over death. The death of God in Christianity is thus marked by uncompromising instrumentality. God dies so that he may be resurrected, simple as that. The instrumental outcome is all that matters, and the reality of God's death, God's suicide to be exact, vanishes behind the interminable ritual repetition of a mythical spectacle rendered sacred. In retrospect, after two millennia, it seems that the death of God in Christianity was meant to abolish once and for all the possibility that God may be rendered truly irrelevant to our existence, that God may be voided. It is a mark of humanity's ultimately untamable psychic core that such imaginary possibility has still not been extinguished. Nietzsche's death of God may be considered, on the one hand, as the final act of Christian thinking, but on the other hand, it may be the first act of unchristian thinking from within, because it also signaled the death of the resurrection and a return to life as actualization of mortality. Living with a sense of utter mortality, of plain finitude, diminishes the hold of death over life. If death is zero, then all life before it curiously becomes infinity and plenitude in every infinitesimal, ephemeral, and unreproducible moment. If the zero of death is undone by the promise of an eternal afterlife, a promise that turns infinity itself into a promise, then death's zero expands backwards all over life, and like a radioactive cloud envelops it and removes from it all temporality. It annihilates its life force and hollows it out into a perfunctory shell yearning to be filled with promise. To live as if God does not matter in full cognizance of annihilating mortality, therefore, is to live in ways that cannot be measured in the spectrum of belief, in ways that cannot be measured at all. It is to make a wager, but quite unlike Pascal's skepticism as it is often reproduced in the popular imagination, believe in God because you got nothing to lose. If he exists, you will be rewarded, and if he doesn't, it won't matter. Instead, the wager is of a greater risk. Be unconcerned with the divine. Be concerned, show compassion, care for what is human, even if what is human is oftentimes abominable. Dogmatic believers would counter with a warning that such pronouncements bring upon me the full force of divine wrath, the loss of eternal bliss. But if I only care for this life, this one fragile, inadequate, ephemeral, but also precious small life, in the midst of other equally inadequate and precious small lives, where is the loss? Even if I may grant that there is a loss, it is irrelevant. If I have chosen to reside fully in the incalculable, surely I don't need to calculate how many chips it takes to enter paradise. It goes without saying that an argument about the irrelevance of the divine cannot be conducted neutrally as a moral, philosophical, or scientific argument. It is embedded in the performative politics of worldliness. This is a politics conscious of making history only for the sake of history, in full cognizance that as history, it is condemned to be overwritten, overturned, and overtaken. To borrow a phrase from Sadia Abbas, worldliness cannot turn history into theodicy. This could be its demise. A succinct moment of such atheist performativity is Woody Allen's famous quip in Stardust Memories, all the way back in 1980, if you remember, where his character responds to the accusation of being an atheist as, "To you, I'm an atheist. To God, I'm just the royal opposition." Such performative politics renders belief or unbelief in God immaterial, much as it renders the question of God's existence or non-existence irrelevant. More significantly, it thereby exposes that both discourses, belief and unbelief, consist in producing an authority materialized out of the immaterial, which occludes the encounter with worldly things that really matter. There is no way that the issue can be resolved by taking cover behind some sort of non-committal agnosticism. Thank you. I don't really know if God exists or not, so I withdraw judgment on the matter. This one counters with Ludwig Wittgenstein's assertion that a strictly agnostic position is impossible. I cannot presume not to know with a certainty of knowledge. In Wittgenstein's sense of language, I cannot say I know that I don't know, Socrates notwithstanding, without compromising the radical power of non-knowledge, which is not, of course, ignorance. I cannot presume not to know because I would have to imagine, therefore know, what it is I don't or cannot know. In this respect, a dogmatic atheism, according to which God's non-existence would be positively proposed, would entail a self-defeating principle, entirely self-enclosed in the regime of belief in the name of unbelief. Indeed, a dogmatic atheism assumes that it can speak of God's non-existence as a transcendental position, that is to say, as if this non-existence exists beyond the world. And in Wittgenstein's language, the quotation is famous, "The world is all that is the case." What's left, then? To seriously encounter the Wittgensteinian demand would mean to perform atheism without the least necessity, desire, or investment in its truth. To be an atheist without the least concern to prove the validity of its meaning. This is precisely where I part from the rationalist atheism of Dawkins, Harris, or Christopher Hitchens, actually. But why should one perform at all in this context, especially if one rejects the appeal to reason, or in this case, secularism, as another instance of transcendentalist metaphysics? Apart from the strategic answer that pertains to a specific politics that seeks to counter the globality of religious politics, which has been efficiently disguised in Samuel Huntington's culturalist language of the clash of civilizations, the answer involves a crucial subversive dimension. Living your life by performing the fact that God does not exist solely in the sense that God does not matter, and not because you have a stake in the ontological status of the question of whether God is or is not, is to destabilize any guarantee of providence or destiny. This opens life to infinite possibility, even if ever presently putting life at risk. Such lack of guarantee in meaning entails, of course, a tragic condition in altogether extreme terms. In moments of absolute happiness, of fulfillment, you have to remember, though this memory will do nothing in itself to compromise, subvert, or avert this condition, that such happy moments may constitute just as well moments of unraveling, of undoing, perhaps of destruction. Before you, there will ever presently be raised the risk of hubris. Yet hubris may be the only legitimate concept, philosophically speaking, of non-knowledge. Like God, hubris cannot be known until its consequences are revealed or realized. But you must live as though you know it. When even your happiness or your fulfillment may be a force that generates hubris, you nonetheless cannot but embrace what you love unequivocally. But unlike God, hubris is the other to truth, capital T. It is an interpretive horizon about something to be that has nothing whatsoever to do with attending, waiting, or longing for a future to be revealed. When you perform your life in the face of hubris, you decide not to forget its existence. Forgetting hubris, it's the quintessentially hubristic position. Yet you can do nothing to suit your existence to its unknown presence. Of the two unknowables, I decide for hubris over God. Perhaps this is itself the ultimate hubris, one could say. Yes, if hubris is constituted as a transgression of the divine, but not at all if hubris is a condition of the world. All undoing of human existence is conditioned of human action, thereby worldly matter. This is why currently fashionable theories of unmitigated catastrophe as desirable events of radical social historical transformation, theories seeking a pure aesthetics of catastrophe, are ultimately consumed by theological tropes. I mean, you know, there's a whole bunch of people who are into this now. Zizek certainly is one of them. In the face of this tragic predicament, of this ever-present arche of unraveling, every one of my actions bears the fullest meaning, even the minutest, the most trivial action. Every action pertains to something incalculable, and as such may be the last action, the one that grants final necessity and final meaning to my entire life, the one action that ends my life, the one that gives or ends life for someone else, the one that interrupts all that is given, the one that traverses or reverses all ends. Such tragic condition entails an irredeemable sadness. We speak of Achilles' wrath in the Iliad, but it's his sadness that's sublime. A sadness whose presence persists beneath the greatest and most genuine happiness, even before the moment of real openness to the other. This sadness is not caused by anything external, nor is it resolvable by things external. Thus, it is never an obstacle to love, pleasure, or good humor, to the laughter that the jouissance of mere existence induces unannounced. Now, the kind of language I'm using generates commonplace misunderstandings. Invocation of the tragic produces assumptions of a dark, ungenerous existence. Nothing could be more contrary. A tragic existence is foremost reliant on a humorous relation to life's adventures, an ironic reception of the abyssal elements of what it means to be, to live, and to die, without meaning, except for whatever meaning each one of us poetically conjures out of what seems to be nothing, but is the groundless non-meaning of things as such. What in modernist literature was termed the absurdity of existence emerged consistently when and where transcendental repositories of safety had vanished. Whatever the reason, that would be another discussion. It is curious that many people recognize Samuel Beckett being brilliantly tragic in the deepest and most exhilarating moments of his comedic humor. Yet in invoking images of the tragic in real life, they instantly turn somber and morose as if they just violated some ceremonial savoir-faire. My sense is that discourses and practices of belief, including the atheism of belief, denigrate the horizon of decision. Contrary to what seems to be the case, namely that believers, by virtue of having conviction, are more steadfast in acting out of conviction, we say, acting on our beliefs, etc., the conditions of belief make all decisions predicate to an originary and binding decision, the decision to believe. The decisions of believers are mere reproductions of decisions. That's why they come so easy, if that's what steadfastness is assumed to mean. Now, I mean, I'm mocking this assumption, obviously. The textual legacy of the trials and tribulations of belief are legion. But this alleged steadfastness of the believer's decision is a delusion. Because if decision is to mean anything politically, it must bear the full impact of what Walter Benjamin named interruption. Let us remember that Benjamin's dialectical mind demands that we understand this interruption not to occur merely in the external realm, the handbrake that stops history's runaway train, according to the famous metaphor, but internally as well. Every decision is an interruption of the self, an interruption of the given parameters of being. Now, in contrast, I would argue that the performance of atheism, which produces the condition of permanent disbelief, raises the stakes on the exigency of decision. I mark disbelief in the full range of signification. The condition of being in awe before the world, the experience of wonder, the pleasure of discovering that there's always more to discover. Disbelief deconstructs both belief and unbelief, as well as their intrinsic mutually affirming tension. I opt for disbelief here in the same way that I opt for wonder over miracle. In Greek, the word is the same, thavma. In Erasmian, it would be, I guess, what, thauma. But pardon me again, as I said last time, in my Greek pronunciation. But with two radically different meanings before and after the advent of Christianity. The notion of miracle, rendered in New Testament Greek as thavma, definitively deprives us of the conscious practice of thavmazim, in Aristotle's language, a bona fide philosophical attitude drawn from the utmost origins of mythical thinking. And I'm quoting here what is in fact a famous quotation from Aristotle's Metaphysics. For it is owing to wonder, thavmazim, that human beings began and continue still to philosophize. And a man who's puzzled, and the word for puzzled is aporon, aporia, right? And a man who's puzzled and wondering, thavmazim, thinks himself ignorant, whence even the lover of myth is, in a sense, a lover of wisdom. Philomythos, philosophos, pos estin. For myth is composed of wonders. Ogar mythos syngite ek thavmasion. The wondrous element that myth articulates in Aristotle's phrase emerges from and never ceases to reside within a physis, in nature, in the Greek sense, no matter how extravagant or extraordinary a thavma might seem. Myth is how nature speaks, in a sense, and though there may still be something enchanting in mythical speech, the source of it remains immanent to the wondrous nature of the cosmos itself. This was the singular contribution of pre-Socratic naturalist philosophy, which placed all aspects of the divine or the supernatural within and not outside or above a natural cosmos that exists at the behest of its own law-making capacity, thereby excising thavma from its initial condition as, quote, the intellectual foundation of magic. This is a beautiful phrase by Gregory Vlastos, one of the great commentators of pre-Socratic philosophy. In contrast, what is subsequently recoded as miraculous is explicitly constituted to index whatever contravenes the nature of the cosmos. It is literally metaphysical, which is why its claimed physical appearance is so otherworldly, in fact, the epitome of the otherworldly. Of course, this doesn't stop people from investing in the reality of miracles, even when entrusted with positions of public responsibility. I remember a few years ago, the remarkable comments made publicly by none other than a Supreme Court justice, albeit the court's most colorful personality, I'm talking about the U.S. Supreme Court, Justice Antonin Scalia, which were posted as instructions to the faithful as to how they can resist the malign disregard of the infidel multitude against the glorious reality of virgin birth. I quote from the Justice Scalia. It is not irrational to accept the testimony of eyewitnesses who had nothing to gain. He's talking about eyewitnesses to miracles, huh? If I've brought any message to you today, it is this. Have the courage to have your wisdom regarded as stupidity. Be fools for Christ. And have the courage to suffer the contempt of the sophisticated world. Performing the conventional Orwellian doublespeak of the Bush era, Justice Scalia is unabashedly producing extraordinary syllogisms, like, it is irrational not to accept first-hand accounts of a miracle, objective accounts. Or, have the courage to have your wisdom, which is your objective knowledge of miracles, regarded as stupidity by those stupid enough to think themselves sophisticated. That's the logic. No need, I imagine, to elaborate on how another way of registering the meaning of sophisticated is to say worldly. From that standpoint, Scalia's enthusiastic exhortation to be fools for Christ, which is actually a phrase from Paul's Corinthians 1, is literally flaunting the idea, don't hesitate to be unworldly, or don't hesitate to subscribe to the truth, or even more, to the rationality of the otherworldly miracles. Of course, the fact that all purveyors of doublespeak are caught in their own equivocal logic hardly registers when one espouses stupidity without question, especially when stupidity is coded as the way to reason. So the underlying significance of having made the miracle into a worldly category, the matter of disinterested observation, anyone can observe it, eyewitness testimony at a definitive point in history, and so on, is conspicuously denied. The double logic merely reverts to its other side. The miraculous is, after all, a self-sufficient category. A miracle is a priori miraculous, and for this reason alone, otherworldly. Which is precisely why the sophisticated world cannot even remotely entertain its true significance. This is also why it is not only preposterous, but patently abject to pursue a scientific explanation of, say, the parting of the Red Sea, as was recently announced by the National Center for Atmospheric Research in the United States, which is conducting research on how the parting of the Red Sea happened scientifically. So either Scalia is playing a very sophisticated game of post-secular sophistry, whereby the merging of adversarial epistemologies is meant just to confound those who do rely on worldly modes of thinking and distinguish the miraculous from the realistic, or he's just a robotic vehicle of the ideology he represents. Namely, the miraculous is both in and out of this world, exactly as are the Christian faithful, who can then act in this world in the name of the other world, even if only to wreak havoc on a global scale with the alibi of being ennobled and redeemed in some future apocalyptic moment that will settle all accounts in their favor. Scalia's audience may not know any better, but insofar as he represents the supreme institution of worldly law, the U.S. Supreme Court, his illogic is in fact a scandal. It is indicative of the scandalous otherworldliness of American politics today that Scalia's invocations of the reality of miracles do not register any scandal, just as George W. Bush's confession that God spoke directly in his ear did not trigger any alarm in the population that the president was routinely suffering from paranoid episodes. In earlier and more sophisticated times, as real philosophers keen to address the miracle in philosophical terms, both Spinoza and Hume agree with different accounts as to its history, that the discourse of the miracle as the contravention of nature is quintessentially religious, having shifted from the signifying framework of magic in polytheism to the signifying framework of divine truth in monotheism. The historical advent of the Christian discourse of the miracle, insofar as it was articulated in the Greek language, thavma, obliterated the explicit association in the Greek imaginary between philosophy and myth, thereby inaugurating the desubjectification of one's wandering relation to a wondrous, astonishing, unpredictable world. As the category of the miracle is self-sufficient, one can only be the object of a miracle, what a miracle acts upon by its happening, one's affect as a result of an external effect. One cannot be the subject of the miracle unless one is God, and God is not a subject, at least in the sense of a living being acting and knowing itself acting in the course of time. In any case, and this is the point of Scalia advocating a militant stupidity, remember, that's what he says, one is bedazzled and bereft before a miracle. Its experience is perfect heteronomy. The desire for a miracle is a desperate desire. In fact, the desire of desperation par excellence. No, we need a miracle to save. On the contrary, the experience of thavmazin, of responding to the world with a sense of wonder, which is always linked to wondering, to questioning what is given, discredits miracles. Opposite to the effect of the miracle, the effect of wonder happens on your side, on the side of experiencing your making and your acting. You induce a sense of wonder in yourself because you remain attuned to the world's wondrous, astonishing fashion. The bliss of astonishment is Heidegger's phrase. You do not, however, produce the miraculous. The miraculous is revealed to you, generated somehow by an elsewhere, as an elsewhere. The miraculous is exceptional because it exempts you, it excludes you. This is why modern theories of miraculous exception, from Schmidt to Agamben and Badiou, are theological theories of exclusionary sovereignty, of heteronomy pure and simple. Regardless of what these theories claim for themselves, that in various ways they exemplify decisionist power, they are the exact opposite. They abrogate the capacity for decision by displacing decision to an undecidable beyond, to a land of miracles. Instead, the uncertainty of wonder, of disbelief, as opposed to the certainty of both belief and unbelief, keeps one exceedingly alert to the politics of decision, to the fact that decisions must be made always anew, not because they don't leave a trail or don't need to be consistently followed up, but precisely because their trail must be interrogated and their consistency tested with a sense of wondering. In this respect, now I'm coming back to some of the things we talked about on Monday, I'm advocating a different sort of skepticism. Not the condition that, by means of interminable negation or constitutive undecidability, leads to indecisionism, but on the contrary, the condition that, by means of constitutive self-interrogation and radical uncertainty, demands precise alertness to the parameters and forces of decision. This obviously presupposes that we learn to be comfortable, or at least unhesitant, with the extraordinary openness of horizon that uncertainty fosters, an openness that requires simultaneously both extremely focused consciousness of the present, as fleeting and ephemeral as it is necessary, and perhaps a kind of mad investment in the future, at least in the wager that makes a future be present, not endlessly deferred. I've often quoted Edward Said in this regard. It's a quotation that I truly love. I quote, "All criticism is postulated and performed on the assumption that it is to have a future." Much as I've argued that Said's bequeath lesson is for us to be at once skeptic and utopian. The presumed incompatibility between these two standpoints illustrates what I have been arguing here. The skeptic forces the utopian to be attentive to the present, to everything that passes before us in order to be judged. The utopian relieves the skeptic from the quicksand of self-absorption into the negative. This makes utopia entirely the work of the present, not the displaced projection to a deferred future, which is actually a gesture of nostalgia. And skepticism becomes the work of what cannot present itself with a certainty that it is not a mere phantasm. Of course, there's nothing prudent about this way of thinking. I'm coming now to my conclusion. There's nothing prudent about this way of thinking. In any case, prudence is irreparably tainted by a kind of Latin Christian meaning, which is why it is an inappropriate translation for Aristotelian phronesis, as it's usually translated. Phronesis is translated as prudence. In fact, I would propose that this sort of affirmative skepticism that I'm arguing is a productive way to rethink the notion of phronesis away from its restricted ethical Aristotelianism. If phronesis is considered as the practice of thinking on the edge of the given, of thavmazin, as he said, that is, exercising critical judgments without preconceived norms and injunctions in astonishment before the world, then it involves a great deal of risk, indeed danger. All transcendentalist ethics, and in societies that include or are products of a monotheistic imaginary, transcendentalism pretty much covers the ethical range. All transcendentalist ethics exist because they cannot handle the risk of phronesis, the risk of thinking and making a decision in the absence of a priori external norms. This is why I reiterate here my critique against the tendency, exemplified by Charles Taylor's The Secular Age and reproduced by many of its acolytes, to celebrate transcendence as resistance to closure. The presupposition of the transcendent as providing an opening is indefensible in and of itself. One may equally argue that the transcendental horizon is the epitome of closure. The presupposition of the transcendent as providing And okay, sorry. One may equally argue that the transcendental horizon is the epitome of closure, insofar as it is constituted on the requirement that the world and the worldly is enclosed in whatever lies beyond it. This beyond is precisely what closes off the infinite unfolding of the worldly. We can have all kinds of arguments about the limits of immanence and transcendence, but we cannot allow closure to be posited as the de facto opposition to transcendence, which thereby validates it. In the end, the point is not to be against transcendence and in favor of immanence, for immanence too may be codified as self-enclosed and thus indisputable domain. This would make immanence a transcendental domain too, in the precise sense that my friend Andreas Kalyvas, political theorist, names the transcendental to be, that is to say, in his mind, whatever domain is taken out of the field of contention. Really like this definition of the transcendental. Whatever domain is taken out of the field of contention. To conclude, atheism is an existential position directed against both religious faith and transcendental reason equally. And it is based on a tragic view of life against which both morality and rationality as unacknowledged derivatives of transcendentalism are driven. But atheism is also a historical horizon, a specific social imaginary signification instituted at the same time as theism, this religious imaginary in which divinity is an all-consuming but singular, all-signifying but figureless figure. For atheism to vanish, all theism must vanish. As of now, an unimagined social historical horizon. Perhaps such horizon could be thought to bear the most credible meaning of the post-secular, except that by then we will have done well to have invented another name. Thank you.